This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 6th. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me in the studio this morning is
Melissa Idris.
Good morning, Melissa.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Big plans for the weekend?
Oh, actually, I do have big plans. I'm actually going on holiday next week, Han. So
I am so jealous.
I am. Well, I've got some cuddle time scheduled with my niece in Australia, so I'm going to go and see her this weekend and maybe spend some time with her next week.
Oh, that's very nice. Auntie Mel is making a visit. Yes. Awesome stuff.
I'm in auntie mode at the moment.
Very nice. All right, now let's catch you guys up on some headlines. So the aftermath of the Las Vegas shooting, that's still dominating headlines. And now the National Rifle Association, which is an extremely influential gun rights lobby in the States. Now, they have rather uncharacteristically called for additional regulations. Now, it's specifically for bump stocks, which is a tool or device that enabled the Las Vegas gunmen to fire at a faster pace.
Yeah, I mean, this was quite uncharacteristic of them to say, okay, well, let's consider additional regulations. I wonder whether Las Vegas was a turning point. I mean, given that he did use these kind of semi-automatic rifle to spray like an automatic rifle, right?
Well, I would caution against any exuberance. Because in the same in the same statement, because the NRA also still pressed Congress, U.S. Congress, to allow for gun owners in different states with perhaps more lax gun ownership rules to be able to bring those same guns into other states which perhaps have more or stricter gun control. So they are still pressing ahead with that agenda. Just an interesting note here, that a bump stock, that tool, that device that allowed the gunman to
shoot
faster.
It's like an additional thing you can fasten onto the,
the
rifle.
So you got a semi-automatic gun and that allows kind of transform the gun into like a machine
gun. Fully automatic.
That bump stock was actually approved during the Obama administration. So they're trying to reverse that now. On to what's happening in Europe. The Spanish separatists, now they have encountered some resistance from Spain's highest court. Plenty of sibilance in that sentence there. The Constitutional Court has suspended a meeting for Catalonia's regional government that's planned for Monday. Now, that's presumably because that meeting after the weekend on Monday was seen as the very timely chance for Catalan President Carles Puigdemont to announce Catalonia's declaration of independence.
Well, yeah, he's adamant about going ahead with this declaration of independence. But, I mean, Madrid is against it. The courts are against it.
The king is against it.
I don't know how this is going to work out. And what's also a little bit troubling is that the rest of the European Union seems to look at this issue and say, well, I think this is a domestic policy affair, so we're not going to meddle, but it's going to have some spillover effect if it does take place.
And our Market Watch guest from yesterday, Ben Lebrano, described it as a potential contagion effects, you know, because what investors will be seeing, you know, how this plays out, if Brexit was kind of let off easy, then why shouldn't Spain have their say as well? Now, whether or not this will have reverberations across the continent, that remains to be seen. We have seen Spanish assets take a tumble, but wider European assets, that seems to be resilient, at least for now. We're going to take a short break, and coming up, though, we'll be discussing whether the gig economy is the equivalent of modern-day sweatshop. That's coming up right here on BFM 89.9. And that's Earth, Wind and Fire with Reasons right here on your morning run, setting a very romantic tone for your Friday morning.
Well, leading up to the weekend.
Yeah, certainly. 9 minutes past 6 a.m. now on this Friday, October 6th. Han and Melissa with you. Now, let's now consider whether the gig economy has been romanticized or you know, is the gig economy the modern-day sweatshop?
Well, I think this discussion was kind of essentially reignited after Uber was stripped of its license to operate in London. And, you know, Uber being kind of the face of the gig economy in recent times. So that was a huge blow. And there was a lot of hand-wringing afterwards, you know, what will this mean for Uber drivers, for consumers? And then there was discussion about the gig economy itself in Europe, right? In London, whether it kind of fit into the cultural values that European businesses hold to. Because at the heart of the gig economy essentially is low pay, no social coverage, and no corporate responsibility. And that's what they're arguing. They're saying European values are different than that. Companies should be taking care of their employees.
Right, but on the other hand, the appeal for the gig economy is that you then are in control of your schedule. Right? You take those rides when you want to, you work when you want to, and you don't work when you don't want to, right? So whether or not that has enough appeal in light of, again, like you said, no social coverage, no low pay, or presumably low pay, and no corporate responsibility. Because you would think that, say, in a gig economy, when you charge clients, I'm thinking of like, say, well, not graphic designers because they probably have low pay as well, but
right.
Perhaps something that's more specialized. Because it's a gig economy, you can then charge a premium to your client. Well, that's the rationale.
Yeah, so the idea is each of us in a gig economy are our own bosses, right? Mm. We are consultants that we are selling our skills and our time and our talent. However, that's the ideal. That's the ideal. But the what's happened now, and that's become the point of contention here, is if you take modern day practice today, for instance, Uber, that's not the case. There's worker exploitation. Drivers are not covered. Drivers are kind of made to hit certain targets and drive all hours of the day. In fact, there's also reports that Uber uses data science or gamification and behavioral economics to motivate their drivers. Mm. It's almost a form of exploitation, in a sense, using data.
So one then has to wonder if the gig economy will be limited to just the elite few, you know, as in really highly skilled people, whereas the masses, like the idea of being able to, you know, just be an Uber driver and have a sustainable, you know, income, that notion is gone. I mean, as evidenced by what's happening in London, what's happening in other economies as well. I think it was banned in the Philippines as well, right?
I have to agree. I don't think that there should be kind of a blanket statement that the gig economy is bad, right? There's pros and cons, and the way to look at that is to kind of address what the cons are. Mm. Because essentially the gig economy rewards hustle. If you hustle, you get rewarded in the gig economy, you know, which is capitalism essentially. But when you look at who benefits from a gig economy, it really is the marginalized workers. The biggest beneficiaries are those people who are stuck in the margins of traditional jobs, the retirees, the stay-at-home parents, the elderly, students. They all get to participate in the economy. The ones who lose the most will be, as you say, traditional blue-collar workers who then see their jobs as, you know, I mean, this is, perhaps the gig economy is not beneficial to them.
Right. I mean, one also has to assume that there are enough opportunities whereby if you hustle enough, then you can get justly rewarded. Because I know from my experiences here in Malaysia, when speaking with Uber or Grab drivers, because of the influx of people jumping onto this platform, you know, there's just not enough. I mean, the pie is still limited. There's just not enough gigs to go around. So in a gig economy, for it to be successful to begin with, the underlying assumption is that there has to be enough gigs to go around for that many participants in the gig economy. Otherwise, then you're just losing out. You're getting, you know, a pittance, right? As opposed to having that security that comes with that 9-to-5 or 9-to-5 in Malaysia, if you're lucky, right? Like 9-to-5 job and having the health benefits and the paid days off, etc., etc., right? So I think there are many, many elements to this discussion here. But, you know, one also has to wonder whether or not this idea of employers, you know, having to take care of their employees, you know, whether the onus is really on them as opposed to saying putting that power into people's hands.
Yeah, you can always get your own insurance.
Yeah,
right?
Get your own insurance, you know, and this is where the gig economy is important. Well, something to discuss. Hey, if you have any thoughts on this discussion, whether or not the gig economy is the modern day sweatshop, do send in your WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. Or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, coming up in just a bit, we'll talk about school for you parents, perhaps sending your kids on your school runs right now. How to improve school results? Not extra math, but what? We'll tell you after this, right here on BFM 89.9. Baby by Devendra Banhart, right here on BFM 89.9. Good morning, 21 minutes past 6 a.m. It's Friday, October 6th. Han and Melissa here with you on your morning run as you parents are perhaps getting your kids ready for the school day. Now, as you do that, Let's consider this question. How do we improve school results? Because according to this particular school in Bradford, UK, the answer is not additional math. It's not additional homework. It's more music. Plenty of it. And perhaps maybe more tunes like the one we just heard from Banhart.
You know? Yeah. Okay, the headline was a little... for me, when I read it, I was like, oh, really? That's interesting. But apparently, this school, the head teacher had embedded music, drama, and art into every part of the school day with up to 6 hours of music a week for every child. And they had found remarkable results from it. So every child gets at least 2 hours of music. They get a half hour music, follow-up lessons, songs are incorporated into classes, and they often sing about timetables or history. So it's really not just, you know, you're not singing the latest, I don't know, Taylor Swift song. You're singing songs about
Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Educational song, okay. About timetables or math or history. And what they found remarkably was that 74% of its students achieve the expected standard of reading and writing above the national average of 53% in the schools. National average of 53% around the country. So the school was over exceeding the national average. And I thought it was remarkable that they had implemented this.
Now, yeah, so one has to wonder whether or not this kind of success can be seen elsewhere as well if we were to roll out the same system, especially in the Asian context. Because, you know, here in Asia, stereotypically, we are very much STEM centric, right? So that's being the science, technology, engineering, and math, right? So it's a lot of rote learning and memorizing the formulas and learning how to execute the various methods, right?
You know, now there's also a growing debate that STEM should be turned into STEAM. That means you inject an A in there, A for the arts.
Okay.
So, yeah, so rather than just be STEM focused, you move it into kind of a more holistic approach and look at STEAM instead with science and arts together.
Yeah, and I think a big component to the success of such a program would rest on the teachers, right? Because you hopefully would get a musically inclined teacher to begin with. Can you imagine having to do 6 hours of music with a teacher who's just offbeat and off key the whole time? That's terrible.
But it comes down to the perfection, the perception, isn't it, Han? I mean, we often talk about, as you just mentioned, you know, in this Asian culture, we have that focus on STEM because we think that it leads to a better future, better jobs, more security.
Right. I mean, now from my involvement in the gig economy, I am a tutor as well. And good God, the number of times I've heard parents basically tell me to really, really make sure that their kids excel and get that A+. That's all they care about. And especially in the core subjects, they do not entertain the idea of, you know, studying history, geography. Like, nah, it's useless, right? We want them to do the physics, the bio, chemistry, math, ad math, stats.
Right? Wow.
I even have one of the students I tutored, 12 years old, currently taking the IGCSEs right now. I asked the parents, are you sure? And they insist. 12 years old,
he is so young.
So, you know, you have this prevailing mindset among parents, especially here in the Asian context here. So whether or not the idea of having 6 hours of music a day, whether that will really fly with Asian parents. We're coming up to the 6:30 news. Between now and then, again, be sure to send in your thoughts. 018-789-8899. More music or more math for your kids' success. We'll be back with more after the news right here on BFM 89.9. Cemetery Gates by The Smiths, right here on BFM 89.9. Han and Melissa with you this Friday morning. Once again, discussing the net effects of digital detox. You know, is it that supposed cure for technology overload? I mean, does it really, you know, given with all the notifications, all the buzzers, the rings and etc., right? That, you know, can you really get anything done, you know, let alone try to produce any kind of creative work?
Yeah, so they say that, okay, if you want to be more creative, if you want to have more focus, more energy, less stress, why don't you try a digital detox? And that's been the prevailing narrative around how to shut out all that noise from our technology. But really, is that the best way? And I think now there's some pushback coming from this, because if you think about it, disconnecting is somewhat unrealistic for most of us, right? Mm-hmm. We can't just switch off completely. We need to stay connected for one reason or another, be it work or family or even just personal pleasure. So that the question is, how can we get the best of our creative minds to work while incorporating this as part of our lives? So we have to find a way to kind of shut out some elements of, so not a full digital detox, I would say, like don't go hardcore digital detox, but finding ways to shut out some of the noise.
Right. Again, I think there are many, many factors that go into this decision, whether or not you can engage in digital detox to begin with, depending on your commitments and whatnot. But I think what's key here is also recognizing the trade-offs, though, because, you know, if, especially in our line of work, Mel, you know, if we were to go on this digital detox and if there's breaking news, right, and especially for those in the wires or those on in the digital media realm, right, you can't really afford to engage in digital detox, because then if you are found wanting and this piece of breaking news passes you by,
your phone is turned off, yeah, and you're just la la la.
Yeah, have fun trying to explain that to your boss.
Okay, so but I also would like to challenge this assumption. They say that if you put your phone away, so most people say if you put your phone away, that will give you more time to yourself and perhaps less stress. And I want to say that most people go to their phones to escape stress. Right?
But
it's a stress reliever for most people because it's a form of escapism. So really, I don't know whether digital detoxing would allow for less stress.
Well, still, there's a related story on the use of social media or digital media by the younger generation. This piece coming in The Guardian. So in a survey of about 5,000 students at independent and state schools across England, almost two-thirds of school children would not mind if social media had never been invented. Like they knew a time before social media
I don't
existed.
Think they have a comparison. However, what we do have to take from this is the fact that they too are trying to use kind of these temporary digital detoxes simply because young people are exposed to the negative effects of being on social media, and that's really taken an impact on their emotional well-being.
Right, you know, be it online abuse, fake news, or just this constant need to get those likes and, you know, be this pseudo-influencer, you know, if you want to call it.
Pseudo-influencer.
Right, you know, I mean, everybody wants to be an influencer, and right now, so it's...
That's a new job title.
No, seriously.
Job of the future.
You have no idea how many of my kids have their own YouTube channels as well, you know,
wow.
Trying to do all this stuff. You know? So, still, you got 63% who would not care if they did not exist. Even more, 71% said they had taken up temporary digital detox.
So, just to clarify, when you say how many of your kids, you're talking about your students.
Yeah. not my biological...
If there was
kids.
Like a...
At least not ones that I know of yet.
Okay, there we go. Well, it's a Friday.
Okay, well, so the Evening Edition team did speak to Dr. Julian Hopkins, who is a lecturer in communication at the School of Arts and Social Sciences at Monash University. So they asked him whether a digital detox was a feasible solution. Well, apologies for that. Seems like we have some technical difficulties. We'll try to get a clip for you in just... Oh, right now. Let's try this again. Dr. Julian Hopkins.
I think I wouldn't advise anybody to completely shut themselves off from social media, and especially younger people, because it is part of their social life. But moderation is usually the best way to go. I mean, if you feel you're spending too much time on social media, you probably are. For myself, there are apps and plugins you can use to limit the time you use, which can be a useful way of just keeping an eye on yourself or your children.
And that was Dr. Julian Hopkins, lecturer in communications at the School of Arts and Social Sciences at Monash University, perhaps suggesting moderation is the best way to go. But hey, if you want to engage in digital detox, you can just always stick to good old FM radio. How about that? This is BFM 89.9. We'll be back with more right after this. The Beatles with Here Comes the Sun. Perfect song there for 6:50 a.m. Thank you so much for tuning in to BFM 89.9. This is the Morning Run. Han and Melissa with you. Now, let's talk about another kind of sun, your sons and daughters. So, a few days ago, the Minister of Women, Family and Community Development, Minister Dato Sri Rohani Abdul Karim, suggested that suspension from school should be replaced with rehabilitation or transition classes. So psychologists, they have responded positively to the suggestion, pointing out that some troubled students see suspension as a reward for bad behavior.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, I mean, this is because troubled teens are often reluctant to go to school in the first place. So if you suspend them, then it's like, hooray, I don't have to go to school. I can do what I want.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot here, Melissa Idris.
Have I ever been suspended?
You saw that one coming.
No, I was a really good girl.
Yeah, same here.
School monitor. What? Class monitor.
Oh, yo, yeah. I mean, I was that during my primary school days, but not in secondary. But, you know, nevertheless, so the question here is whether or not suspension is still an effective method of punishment in today's context.
Well, right? Suspension is seen as a punishment because, you know, if you think about the workplace, right? You are suspended. If you're suspended from work without pay, means, you know, it deprives you of your salary. If you suspend students, you're depriving them from receiving an education. So it's seen to be a punishment. But in the eyes of that teen, right, is that really the case?
Yeah, and also another line of reasoning for suspensions is that, oh, it deprives these kids of social contact. But in today's day and age, they don't need to go to school for social contact. They have this multitude of social media platforms whereby they can interact with friends.
Unless they're on a digital detox.
So it's a suspension plus a digital detox. That is a real punishment right there. Or take away the Wi-Fi password, right? That's the name of the game. We spoke to the consultant psychologist, Paul Jambunathan, and asked him what would be some better alternatives for suspension.
The alternative for suspension would be some deliberate action, some kind of plan of action kind of stuff where people have some kind of a SOP, standard operating procedure. Now, I think what's happened is people have used suspension very easily, very quickly, because they don't know what to do. So let's suspend this. And what I sadly see sometimes is indefinite suspension and continuing suspension till the boy is severely deprived of an education, of structure, sometimes even exams, and it's a really sad situation. The alternative would be some serious investigation and counseling and clarification of the problem. And through that procedure, you actually determine a more appropriate kind of punishment if necessary, or some kind of restructuring of whatever is necessary as an intervention.
And that was consultant psychologist Paul Jambunathan. And we followed up by asking him, what needs to be in place for these alternative measures to be properly implemented in schools?
With regard to counsellors, I know for a fact that now the Ministry of Education employs counsellors in many, if not all, schools. And one of the important things to do is to rectify and clarify the role of the counsellors within the school system. That's one thing to do. Second thing is, I'm not too happy with the counsellors I've met so far, the counsellors that are posted in schools, as to how they actually deal with and interact with students themselves. I've met some very, very good ones, but the majority of them are just, they're not playing an interventionist kind of role. Now, one of the important things is for schools to make sure the counselors are updated, trained, and on the ball regularly, involved with students' lives, and they must be the go-to person for any issue dealing with student welfare, student behavior, and things like that. So the particular training and establishment of a good counseling system in all schools must be there. I do not think it's sufficient enough.
consultant psychologist Paul Jambunathan there talking about the effectiveness of suspension in schools. And I agree with him because I guess from an educator's perspective, you know, when you deal with dozens or sometimes even hundreds of kids on a daily basis, right, you just don't have the resources to be counseling every single problem kid. So suspension is often seen as a more effective, efficient, at least in terms of resources, way of disciplining a child, right? Can you imagine having to sit down and have lengthy discussions with every single child and their parents? It's exhausting.
But that's why I think that counselors should be, you know, not teachers. They should be their own, that's a job role that's separate from teaching. So
right.
Let teachers teach, but counselors counsel, and I think more emphasis. And I think Paul Jambunathan really made some really good points there.
Yeah, no, and once again, obviously, you got to be aware of the cost that comes
sure.
with having counselors at all of these schools. Coming up, we'll have the 7 a.m. news bulletin. But before that, we've got this song by The Strokes that we'll be singing about the time when my weekend will start, 12:51, right here on BFM 89.9. 7 minutes past 7 a.m. This is BFM 89.9. I am Tan Chung Han. With me in the studio is
Melissa Idris.
All right, Melissa, following on from the discussion yesterday here on our show about Bank Negara's comments that Malaysians have relatively low financial resilience. So there's a survey done by the central bank revealing that a vast majority of Malaysians would run out of funds in under a week. Under a week, should they lose their source of income?
Yeah, that was a bit surprising, wasn't it? I mean, that's living on very narrow margins to run out funds under.
There's hardly any savings.
Well, apparently that 32%, just to be precise, 32% of the people surveyed said they will be able to cover at least a week's worth of expenses if they lose their job. Any more than that, they're in trouble. And about 75% of those surveyed said that it would be a struggle to even raise 1,000 ringgit of immediate cash should there be an emergency.
Right, and so one has to wonder, you know, how did we find ourselves, I mean, as a whole, you know, Malaysians, broadly speaking, right, how did we find ourselves in these dire financial straits here?
Yeah. So yesterday, we also reported that Bank Negara Deputy Governor Sheikh Abdul Rashid Abdul Ghaffur said that perhaps the findings of the survey revealed that Malaysians are living for the moment and are displaying some short-sighted tendencies, focusing on instant gratification. The reason being is because 38% rely on personal loans and 47% are engaged in expensive credit card borrowing. So they're using their credit card to fuel their consumption.
Right.
I really wonder whether this is about kind of the short-sighted, happy-go-lucky, living for the moment, or whether it's just a real question of cost of living.
Yeah, having to contend with the how expensive it is to...
Yeah, and wage suppression.
Yeah, to live a comparable or have a comparable living quality, right, when it comes to today's day and age. But then, at the same time, I still think, given the plethora of choices that we have to spend our money right now, be it for entertainment, you know, holidays, your various consumption of goods, etc. You know, I think that has a big part to play as well. And I think choice, ultimately, though, it's down to consumer choice. I think we'll be remiss if we did not highlight that, you know, at the end of the day, we Malaysians still have a choice, you know, on how much we spend.
Well, that's true, but I think that goalpost is shifting. Now, we spoke to a Malaysian insight journalist who wrote a really fascinating piece, or a series of pieces about the cost of living called Kembongnomics, right?
Ah,
about
right.
the cost of ikan kembong and how that's gone up. And you can download the podcast. You can listen to the interview from our BFM app, which you can download on the Apple App Store, Google Play. It's called Kembongnomics, which is a really catchy headline.
Yeah.
It really... the journalist behind this article found that the people she spoke to found that cable TV is not considered a luxury. Wi-Fi is not considered a luxury. It's an essential because you need Wi-Fi, you need connectivity, especially if you're living in urban areas.
Yeah, no, certainly. And so with this ongoing discussion, we spoke to Nirmala Subramaniam from AKPK, or the Credit Counseling and Debt Management Agency. So we asked her, why are we in this situation? And is this a result of a lack in financial discipline, or is it because of low wages and a higher cost of living?
I think it will be both factors, because one, you have internal, and one, you have external factors also. Because we have seen in cases where some high earners, and if they don't manage it well, it will not last too. So it's the financial discipline there. But at the same time, external factors like low wages and high cost of living will definitely make it also difficult for us to start saving and, you know, to keep for rainy days and stuff like that. It plays a part together, actually.
And we also asked her whether this is a universal problem or are Malaysians just particularly bad at planning for those rainy days?
I mean, if you look at cost of living towards income, there are some researches done by Khazanah National as well. And we do see some nations where they do face the same problem. And I would say it is a universal problem. It's just not in Malaysia. So among the developing countries, it's quite a common issue, actually, because people are actually striving between the income, between the discipline, between the spending, and the lack of education there, telling them to save. Anybody who's thinking about saving, they're just thinking about big amounts. So I can't save 200 or 300, so why bother save? But actually, saving starts from a very small amount. So that's what we are seeing.
Again, we are speaking to Nirmala Subramaniam from AKPK, or the Credit Counseling and Debt Management Agency. And Mel, you know, we spoke about this yesterday as well, how the household debt to GDP in Australia, 120%, right, to
yeah,
GDP.
What a whopping figure.
Right, versus here in Malaysia, it's just under 90%. Next, we also asked Nirmala Subramaniam whether she has seen more Malaysians even wanting to learn about financial literacy.
Yeah, I think there is, because we do a lot of programs in the universities and colleges, and we can see that, you know, even students, young ones, are very interested to know how can they actually manage their money, because they know it's going to be tough to buy a house or property. So we do see there are a lot of queries, a lot of questions after a session is being done, and they're very interested to know how they can actually manage things better. So we do see an increase even in the number of sessions we get for financial education. As things get tougher, people would want to know how can they make it through. So I think we do see that many would want to actually learn more.
And finally, we asked Nirmala what has been the most effective lesson.
What we see very effective, because you see there's two things. One is financial education. Financial education is like increasing your knowledge. Whether it translates into behavior or not is another thing. What I know and what I do is two different things there. So even I may know it's wrong, but I'm at that point of time, and what do I decide to do? So that's behavior part we see is the most critical part that we need to address and change. And we find most effective way is by hand-holding. We do a lot of focus group where, okay, we monitor you over a certain period of time, and with constant intervention, yes, we see a better result. So we feel that financial education should start very young. There should be constant intervention. It's just not a one-time touch-and-go base and people will forget. So it should be a constant intervention. There should be reminders, especially at important points during certain life events. Like, if I want to take a loan, then there will be some reminder to say, okay, can you really afford it? Can you really buy the car? Or, you know, other factors. At that point of decision-making, that knowledge must be there.
And that was Nirmala Subramaniam from the AKPK talking about the constant hand-holding and intervention when it comes to improving the level of financial literacy among Malaysians today. Again, 75% of Malaysians would struggle to even come up with 1,000 ringgit in emergency funds. Should they lose their jobs, essentially 1 week, that's all they can, that's all they have saved up for.
Yeah, that's very, that's no buffer for hard times at all, right? And I thought some of the points that Nirmala made were really interesting, particularly because, Malaysians are interested in financial literacy, and I'm really saddened that we don't implement this more or at an earlier age. And that's something that BFM feels very strongly about, particularly the Morning Run, about having, you know, some kind of financial literacy or financial education. Yesterday we had our Ringgit and Cents show, which is our personal finance show, and I love Ringgit Ringin because, you know, it gives me a sense of what people are asking, what people want to know. So that's when you call in with your personal finance questions, and we have a financial planner on standby to answer them. And more often than not, Han, we get really basic questions. And that tells me that people need basic financial education. Questions like, does budgeting help me? How do I save? How much do I save from my income? These are things that should be taught in schools and disciplined throughout your as you grow up.
Right. Hence the term hand-holding as used by Nirmala. As always, you can listen to that episode on the BFM app, which can download on the Google Play Store or also the Apple App Store. Coming up, we'll be taking a look at what's dominating the front pages of the local newspapers. That's coming up right after this, right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.